This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was supposed to be a beautiful vacation on a private island in the Indian Ocean just off the coast of the southernmost part of Sri Lanka. Michael Dobbs, the Washington Post national education reporter, was spending Christmas there with his wife, children, and his brother Jeffrey Dobbs. Jeffrey is a businessman who owns the island and its hotel, as well as three hotels on the coast of southern Sri Lanka. The Dobbs brothers were swimming in the ocean around the island when the waters rose and the tsunami hit the shore. They survived, and so did all the guests and the staff on the tiny island. A little later, we'll talk with Jeffrey about the work he's doing now to help local fishermen and small businesses get back on their feet. First, we'll hear from Michael Dobbs, who's back at home in the Washington, D.C. area. I asked him to describe his swim the day of the tsunami.
I had been going for a swim every day around the island, and about 9 o'clock on the 26th, that's the day after Christmas, I was going for my usual, what had become my usual morning swim around the island. And I guess I was about quarter of the way round when my brother, Jeffrey, started shouting at me from behind. He was also in the water, but a little behind me. And he said, "There's something very strange happening with the sea. Come back." And I couldn't quite understand what he was talking about because it was a beautiful, cloudless day, absolutely perfect sky, and there didn't seem to be a wave in the sea. Then I noticed that the water level was rising very, very quickly. And in the space of about 2 minutes, it raised about 30 feet. And at the same time, I was pushed toward the shoreline by a very, very strong current. Fortunately, both my brother and I managed to grab hold of a fishing boat. The fishermen there have very colorful fishing boats, catamarans, which they use to go out and collect fish. And they're usually just when they're not out fishing, these boats are just there on the shoreline, on the sandy beach. So I grabbed hold of one of those while the water started rising very, very fast. And that, you know, was my initial experience of it, just water rising much faster than I could explain.
When you were in the ocean, how did you realize the water was rising? I mean, you didn't perceive the tsunami as a wave. You just perceived it as the water rising.
Well, I could feel myself being buoyed up by the water and rising very quickly. And also, I saw the island that I'd just come from disappearing because the water level was going halfway up the island. The beach had completely disappeared, and the water was rushing inland. So I had a very strong sense of tide of water rising me up. And I couldn't think immediately of any natural explanation for this. I immediately actually started thinking of the Bible and the book of Genesis and Noah's Ark. Those were the kind of images that came to my mind.
So you grabbed onto a small fishing boat. Was that enough to keep you safe during the tsunami?
Well, lots of these fishing boats ended up half a mile or so inland, crashing against everything in their path and destroying houses and or little fishermen's huts and so on. I later figured out that the boat that we had grabbed hold of had itself jammed against a rather more solid structure. It turned out to be the fishing market, and it was made of concrete. So that boat wasn't going anywhere. And so instead of being swept inland, the boat just rose and rose. It later was torn off its moorings, but that was when the water came out of the bay rather than when it was going in the bay.
Well, were you holding on to the boat still when the water started to recede?
My brother at that point had let go of the boat and waded to the shore because he thought it was safe and that the worst was over. I held on to the boat a little longer, and then when I thought it was safe, I let go of the boat, and what I hadn't figured out was that the water, having gone in, would come out again, and which it did with probably even more force than it had originally come in. So having let go of the boat for a few moments, I felt that I might be swept out to sea. It was a very, very strong current. I'm quite a strong swimmer, so I was able to swim to one of the catamarans that had come loose and was just floating in the sea and grab hold of it. And I guess my weight must have somehow slowed it down because the receding wave overtook us and we were quickly left stranded on the beach.
So when you finally were able to wade on shore, it was on shore of this little island that your brother owns.
That's right. Well, before doing that, actually, I had been worried about my wife because I had, when I went for my swim, she was wading back to the island. I wasn't sure if she'd made it or not. And it turned out that she hadn't. My brother and I went to look for her, and we found her as she was getting down from a palm tree on the other side of the coastal road. She had had actually a more terrifying experience than either my brother or me. She had been caught by the wave. It had pushed her inland across the road. She was underwater for some time. Somebody tried to grab her, one of the local villagers. She couldn't reach out to him. She finally found a piece of rope that was somehow attached to a tree, and she pulled herself up into the tree. She actually has two artificial hips, which have dislocated in the past. We were a little worried going to Sri Lanka in the first place because there's not very good medical treatment, particularly in fairly remote villages where we were. But we took the chance. But it would have been a nightmare if one of her hips had dislocated during this whole ordeal.
But they didn't.
They didn't, although she was sort of held out and being, particularly when the water was receding, she was grabbing onto the tree and the rope. But the hips stayed in place, thankfully.
So was she still in the tree when you found her?
She was just getting down from the tree, worried about what had happened to us.
And where were your children?
The children were still asleep, actually. They were inside the house, about 60 foot up. And when the tsunami struck, more guests staying with us. They were worried about what had happened to us, but they didn't wake the children. So the first thing the children knew about it was when they saw their parents walking, actually, because there was no water in the bay at this point, back across the narrow strait to the island, and they were very happy to see us quite safe and sound.
At what point did you find out the magnitude of the tsunami?
Well, it took place at 9:15, and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we decided to go to a friend's house on the mainland. We waded back. The water was still quite high, but we waded back across the strait, and we took a left turn, which is slightly up the hill. If you take a right turn, you end up in the village of Willagama, which is pretty much on the at sea level. But we walked up the hill, and there was not too much damage because it had been above the level where the water reached. We reached our friend's house, which is actually quite high up on a hill, so they'd suffered no damage at all. But they had radio. We listened to the BBC World Service, and this was the main news on the BBC. And it was beginning to talk about massive casualties all around the South Asian region. So that was when I decided that I really had to get in touch with the newspaper, because up until that point, I'd thought that maybe this is some local Sri Lankan disaster, tidal wave, not many people killed, relatively few people in the U.S. would probably be worried about it. But then I discovered that it was a much bigger disaster than that. So I wrote a story actually back on the island by candlelight and called up my foreign desk, my foreign editor. One of the Australian women had a cell phone. The battery was running out, but the battery lasted and I was able to dictate my story to Washington.
What are some of the other things you witnessed as you were driving around the coast of Sri Lanka?
Well, coming up from Willagama to Gaul, it's about a half-hour drive, but it took us about 2 hours to make the drive. You then got a much clearer sense of the devastation, a sort of ribbon of total ruin, 200 or 300 yards inland, sometimes up to half a mile. It varied a little bit because there's some higher parts of the coast that weren't much affected, but anything at the sea level, pretty much all the houses were ruined, all the businesses, fishing boats inland, vehicles sort of turned upside down, bridges down. I mean, the worst place to be was probably in a vehicle or a train going along the coast, because you were trapped in a confined space and couldn't get out. When we arrived in Gaul, my brother has a little hotel on a hill above the city, so it wasn't affected at all, really. There are still guests, paying guests in the hotel. They've been planning to organize a wedding there later that week. But as soon as we got to Gaul, I walked down into the city center, which was completely devastated. And the worst part of it was Gaul is an old Dutch fortress. The fortress dates back to the 17th century, a huge and very solid structure. The St. Army didn't get into the fortress, but it went round either side of the fortress. And these two rivers of water met at the bus station on the other side of the fortress and completely wiped out the bus station, caught a lot of people in the sitting in the buses, trapped them inside. Many people were killed by either drowned or killed by flying glass. The scene at the bus station was pretty terrible.
What did you see there?
I went down to Gaul. First of all, I walked through what used to be the shopping district of Gaul. I hadn't seen it before, so I'm not quite sure what it was like before. But at any rate, by this time, all the shops were either collapsed, they were in ruins, or they were waterlogged. Whatever possessions had been in the shops had been washed away or looted. There was a little bit of looting there. And so I walked along this sort of scene of just rubble, which bulldozers had already arrived. So they were clearing the streets of rubble. The streets were more or less clear. And then I arrived at a large open space in the middle of Gaul, which used to be the bus station. And the buses were either piled on top of each other, or the waves, the tsunami had taken up a bus from one part of the bus station and tossed it to another part of the bus station 200 or 300 yards away. It was as though, just imagine a bus station with somebody, it's as though somebody had taken, some supernatural being had taken all the buses in their hand and just plunked them in a pile on the side of the on the side of the road. I've experienced two earthquakes before, one in Yugoslavia, one in Romania, and I have never seen quite the destruction that I saw along the coast and in Gaul.
Had the bodies been removed from the buses?
Most of the bodies had been removed from the buses, but they were still there were still some bodies in houses and shops around. That morning, just before I'd arrived in Gaul, actually, the many bodies had been laid out in the sun, row after row of, I guess, mainly bus passengers and people who happened to be there. And they'd been taken away. Some were identified by relatives. Others were buried in mass graves. But the following day in Gaul, the authorities actually closed off the center of the town and refused to let people into the town, because they were sending the army and the police house to house searching for bodies and removing them. And by that time, there was pretty much a stench of dead bodies. So it took 2 or 3 days to remove most of the bodies from the town. And then the day after that, they finally let the townspeople back into the business section of the town. And then the town again began to assume some life. But the first day when I went down there, there were very few people there. They let me down. The police let me in as a journalist, but they weren't letting ordinary townspeople in.
Sri Lanka had a long insurgency in which the Tamil Tigers were fighting against the government. There's been a ceasefire for a couple of years. But, you know, I've been reading reports about how the Tigers have been helping a lot with the relief efforts, how the Tamil Tigers and government people have been talking to each other and collaborating on relief, which is very interesting. Did you witness any of that?
The Tamil-controlled areas of the country are more to the north and northeast. Certainly the eastern coast was very badly affected. We had a reporter there, John Lancaster, and he reported that There was unprecedented cooperation between the government and the Tamil Tigers. There'd been a ceasefire line, and one group wouldn't allow the other group to go into its territory. But there seems to have been a lot more cooperation in the last few days. But I didn't see that myself, as I was right in the south, which is more of is a Sinhalese part of the country controlled by the government. But this did have an impact on this rather tenuous ceasefire between the majority Sinhalese and the Tamils. Also, the tsunami came just as the local economy was getting back on its feet 3 years after the effective end of the civil war. The economy had been pretty much destroyed, and tourists hadn't been going to Sri Lanka for a long time. And this was going to be one of Sri Lanka's best tourist seasons ever, I think. So that's another tragedy about this tsunami, that it came just as the economy was getting back on its feet.
Well, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us, and I'm glad that you and your family, you know, weren't hurt. So anyways, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk with you.
Michael Dobbs is the national education reporter for The Washington Post.